The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hi, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Valdana Hayrick, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And I'm Crystal Kim, crypto reporter at Bloomberg, filling in for Mike Regan.
And this week on the show, Wall Street forecasters have been saying all year that a slowdown in the bull market will be in the cards, thanks to any number of reasons. The average projection for the S&P 500 at the end of 2022 represents a mere 3% advance from current levels. We'll get into all of that with a first-time guest. But first, Crystal, I want to welcome you to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. A lot to be grateful for joining you on this podcast, the endless number of pies waiting to be eaten, and of course, what'll be served up hot at Thanksgiving this year is the conversation. From what I read, seems like the talk around the turkey will be crypto. Macy's is into NFTs, so is the NFL, and Odell Beckham Jr., Martha Stewart is into it, Quentin Tarantino is into it. NFTs have become an all-encompassing subject, and it'll be fun to discuss.
Maybe we can get into all of that with our guest as well. I want to bring in Candace Bangsend. She's a portfolio manager of global asset allocation at Fiera Capital in Montreal. Candace, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Just to start out, I'm hoping you can just lay out your strategy for us, what sectors and areas of the market you're favoring right now, and then how you're starting to think about 2022 as the year closes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our base case scenario is calling for a reflationary recovery. This is essentially an extension of the post-pandemic recovery that inevitably results in an extended period of strong and above-trend global growth. Now, in our base case, this visibility of the cycle is extended, given that policymakers take a very measured and gradual approach to policy normalization and essentially supporting the economy going forward. So this is very much a supportive backdrop for financial markets and particularly stocks over the next 12 to 18 months. Obviously, you know, there's been talk about the global economy, moderating here, but the fact of the matter is that it has peaked at a very elevated levels. And, like I said, will remain strong and above trend without the fear of, premature and aggressive policy normalization that would derail that recovery going forward. So we remain quite constructive on the global economic outlook. We think the dovish reaction function from central banks and the increased tolerance for higher inflation will allow for that more cautious and gradual approach to policy normalization in the coming 12 to 18 months. And together, this will, again, create a favorable backdrop for stocks versus bonds. Now, that being said, we do expect a more challenging environment for equities in the next in the coming year. We've obviously come off a very strong period of outperformance and very robust results in the global equity landscape since the lows of March 20, but also here in 2021 alone. And our sense is that there's fewer obvious catalysts that will push equity markets significantly higher from here, and that the fundamental tailwinds that supported equity markets in the last 18, 19 months have deteriorated somewhat. And as a result, while we don't expect a recession or a bear market for that matter, we do expect more muted and volatile equity market returns going forward after the extended stretch of gains since those March 2020 lows. So here are a couple factors to think about, given our outlook. I mentioned, the fundamental backdrop. And our sense is that when we go down the list, the downside risks are beginning to outweigh the potential for positive surprise, particularly given that much of the good news pertaining to the macro backdrop has likely been priced in at these elevated levels. And this, in our view, could leave some scope for more volatility, disappointment, unwanted volatility, should something go awry. So on the fundamentals front, I mentioned the strong recovery. Earnings have been soaring, but our sense is that, the strong recoveries have likely already been discounted. And this comes on the heels of an environment of rising input prices, inflation, rising wages, as the job market continues to recover. All of this has the potential to squeeze profit margin. So some vulnerability on the profit front. And I think most critically is on the policy front. And we've passed the point of peak stimulus. And this is going to create some uncertainty and some unwanted volatility as policymakers transition from that extremely accommodative stance towards something less accommodative and incrementally so. And while we're not moving to restrictive policy or even neutral for that matter in the next year, that shift from extreme accommodation to something less supportive typically does inject a little bit of volatility in the market. So taken together, those factors, whether it's buoyant earnings expectations, intensifying pressure on margins, and limited scope for further PE expansion, basically has, given us the, an opportunity to take some profits and adopt a more neutral stance on equity markets for the time being.
Candice, you said so many great things, and I want to get into like every element of what you've said, but I want to start at the top with your stance, your economic base case of a reflationary recovery. I was wondering if this week's market events thus far affirm your view. Namely, I'm referencing the largely anticipated continuity in Fed leadership and thus the continuity of the Fed's posture.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the outcome of the nomination process has reinforced that base case for a reflationary recovery. Essentially, like you said, given that, Powell is, back in the chair position for another 4 years, really for us, reinforces the status quo from that perspective. So a little bit more visibility on that front. So again, consistent with, the narrative where policymakers do adopt or, take that more pragmatic approach to policy normalization. So encouraging in that respect.
And then Candice, I was hoping you would sort of walk us through your thinking about some areas of international markets that you might be preferring right now. In particular, I think in one of your recent notes, you said you like Canadian stocks and Japanese stocks. So if you wouldn't mind just going over how you're thinking about things internationally.
Yeah, so while we're neutral overall from an equity perspective, we do see particular pockets of opportunity in certain corners of the market, namely the cyclical value space. So as we all know, the growth defensive stocks have done extremely well with interest rates, tumbling to rock bottom levels. This has basically boosted the valuations of these growth stocks, particularly in the tech space. Over the last, 18 or 19 months. And a lot of that was a result of all of the liquidity that was being injected into the market by central banks, back during the depths of the pandemic. Now, with earnings acting as more of a driver, the global economy is on solid ground. Inflation obviously accelerating, interest rates are rising in response. We expect that rotation from the growth towards the value space to take hold. And this is where we see an opportunity going forward from a valuation perspective alone. Looks like a favorable backdrop for these cyclical value corners of the market. When you think about steeper yield curves boosting financial stocks, higher commodity prices across the board boosting the resource sectors, this essentially underscores our preference for Canadian stocks, given the composition of the Canadian stock market, which is about two-thirds of these value-oriented cyclical sectors of the market. So that's how we play that cyclical value opportunity within the global equity space.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I thought it was interesting that in your base case for stocks next year, for U.S. large caps specifically, you forecast a minus 12.5%. Canadian large cap does better than that. And I wondered if that bakes in the assumptions that value does better than growth in both regions.
So though the matrix that you're referring to and the expected returns are all in Canadian dollars. So the reason that S&P 500 expectation looks so dire is because we expect the US dollar to weaken in the next year and the Canadian dollar to strengthen. So that's actually the currency impact you're seeing there. When it comes to the S&P 500, though, we have exceeded our target. We have a 4,600 target. So the total return is still negative. Or the total expected return, and we still expect some modest upside in Canadian stocks. So it's a relative play between Canada and the US. And like I said, from a valuation perspective, the Canadian market has rarely traded this at this size of a discount to the US. And given that composition and the value-oriented bias of the TSX, we think this is offering more compelling opportunities for equity upside going forward.
And then as Crystal mentioned, we did have the Powell news earlier this week. But the other news that's sort of also happening in the background and happening internationally is the rise in COVID cases, especially in Europe, and some of the headlines that we're seeing there. So I'm wondering how you're thinking about that. I know JP Morgan had a note out earlier this week saying that this new wave is unlikely to be a material problem for stocks. So how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, so I think it adds to that narrative where the risks are mounting at a time when, the markets are largely pricing a lot of good news. While we don't think that these subsequent waves of the coronavirus will derail the economic expansion, it is something that we need to monitor because, of course, it could stall the recovery, like I said, but not to derail it altogether, whether it's given the high vaccination rates, the fact that hospitalizations, mortalities have remained very subdued even in the wake of these subsequent waves. This tells us that we're not likely to see that 2020 recession scenario even in the wake of more stringent countermeasures. But that being said, it is something that I think you'll see more, from a financial market volatility perspective. Again, just something for investors to contemplate. And like I said, the potential for whether it's, some lockdowns or, fear of, traveling or going out again. If you get some of that, deterioration in confidence, that could potentially dampen growth, kind of similar to what we saw in the third quarter of this year. But nonetheless, we don't expect that to derail or to impact our base case scenario. But I think, like I said, you'll see it more through the lens of the financial markets and volatility, you know, as these headlines, you know, hit the screen.
Going back to your base case of a reflationary recovery, I thought it interesting that your firm put it at a 50% probability, if I have that right. What would have to happen to give y'all greater than a coin toss conviction about a reflationary recovery?
Yeah, so the difference between our top two scenarios really hinges on the policymaker response. So in that reflationary recovery scenario, we're essentially assuming that you know, that dovish bias from central banks and that tolerance for inflation to run above target for an extended period of time allows for a slower, more gradual approach to policy normalization. And like I said, that's essentially, you know, what has reinforced our strong outlook for the global economy and, of course, you know, financial markets broadly. Now, the risk to that scenario is if policymakers basically step in prematurely, start to panic, given some of these elevated inflation numbers that we've been seeing, and start to tighten monetary policy, in our view, something that would be prematurely. This would, in response, likely dampen the recovery, if not derail it altogether. And that's, I think, the policy error that people should be thinking about. You know, I've seen a number of headlines about the policy error being allowing inflation to run at these levels without stepping in. I think the policy error at this point would be stepping in prematurely and derailing the recovery at a time when it is still vulnerable.
What happens to U.S. stocks if that happens?
Stock markets in general would sell off in that stagflationary scenario. So that's what that second scenario that you're referring to is, stagflation. And in that scenario, it's an unfortunate outcome, not only for stocks, but also for bonds, because, of course, interest rates would be rising quite aggressively as well. So very much a risky scenario for financial markets in general. And it all really hinges on that policy response, which is very difficult to forecast, to navigate. You know, you see a lot of different headlines, many different policymakers speaking, you know, some more hawkish than others. That's why those probabilities are so close, because there is very much a lot of uncertainty as to how this will all shake out in the next 12 to 18 months.
I'm glad you mentioned that, but you did steal my question, because I was going to ask you if you and your team have projections for what we can expect for interest rate hikes from the Fed. I know John Authors of Bloomberg Opinion had a column this week saying it's a little bit perplexing the way the markets reacted to the Powell renomination, because Brainard actually tends to vote in the same way that Powell does. So how should we be thinking about that?
Yeah, when it comes to the trajectory for Fed funds, we are much more dovish than the market. Following the renomination of Chair Powell, markets are pricing, I believe, close to 5 rate hikes over, you know, 2022, 2023, which we think is overdone, given the, you know, given again the narrative where policymakers will take that cautious approach. We expect only 1 rate hike from the Fed in 2022, obviously in the back half, because of course by the midway through 2022, our sense is that inflation, that acceleration will have receded. And while we still expect inflation to be sustainably above target, we think the focus then will shift to the labor market. And that's where there's still some significant slack. And that's also another precondition for policymakers to start lifting rates, you know, from these rock bottom levels. So again, you know, when you bring in that bias to allow inflation to run at these levels for longer than may have typically been the case after 10 years of underperforming the inflation target, our sense is that policymakers will be in a position to take a slow approach to policy normalization. And therefore, you know, my interpretation is that the markets are leaning a little bit too hawkish and have gotten a little bit ahead of themselves from a policy perspective. And we see that here in the Canadian market as well, a similar narrative.
Right. It seemed to me that earlier this week, gold was backing off and the hedges were coming off. And I wanted to ask you, what are good inflation hedges these days?
I mean, I would say gold actually broke out of its downtrend here just in the last few weeks. I mean, it's been a tough year for gold in 2021. And, you know, investors are starting to fret about that inflation outlook. And in the last few weeks, we've seen gold turn decidedly higher in response as investors seek that hedge in an inflationary environment. When again, you know, if we're right and policymakers take a gradual and, you know, measured approach to policy normalization suggests that real interest rates are going to remain in negative terrain. And this is obviously also a tailwind for gold. That being said, our view and at Fiera, you know, we feel that real assets, you know, such as real estate, agriculture, infrastructure provide the best hedge to inflation over the long term. You know, we expect inflation will remain above that 2% target, not only in the next 12 to 18 months, but over the next 3-4 years as well. So this just really, you know, reinforces the need for real assets in a well-balanced portfolio.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It's interesting you mentioned those things because I had actually been working on a story for Business Week about some of the best inflation hedges, and people had mentioned farmland to me and they mentioned cattle and things like that. Some of these things I frankly had never heard of as inflation hedges before. And then Crystal, I know you and I haven't talked too much about your new beat yet, but you do cover crypto, and Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies come up quite a bit in this conversation. I don't know, Candace, if a lot of your clients are asking you about that as well. It just seems like this big hot topic these days.
Yeah, it's definitely something we're seeing more in the headlines these days. From an asset allocation perspective, we are not, you know, deploying capital towards this asset class right now. Lots of speculation built around that and, you know, very little in the way of tangible value. So I think, you know, from our perspective, you know, not something that we're looking at, you know, proactively at this point.
I hear you. I mean, though, if we're tapped out in terms of return or yield in traditional places, we've got to find them somewhere else. So if not in crypto, where can we go?
That is a fantastic question. And, you know, I've talked about a very challenging backdrop for both stocks and bonds in the coming year. As I already mentioned, you know, while we don't expect a bear market, or a recession for that matter, the easy money has been made in global stock markets. So those similar double-digit returns are going to be tough to come by going forward. At the same time, given our interest rate forecast, particularly at the long end of the curve, you know, the expected returns in traditional bonds, which are supposed to be the, you know, the stability and the income generating aspect of the of a balanced portfolio, you know, we're expecting negative returns, and we've already seen -5% here in 2021 alone, and expect something similar for 2022. So with that, you know, given the, you know, unfavorable return prospects in those traditional bond and equity asset classes, this really, you know, reinforces the need to diversify a portfolio into the private alternative space. So this is where those real asset strategies come into play, whether it's real estate, agriculture, infrastructure, private lending. Obviously, you're getting that nice income stream and the stability of fixed income, but without the the negative return expectation in that we're expecting for traditional bonds, given our expectation for interest rates. So I think these private alternative, non-traditional sources of income will provide a very important part in a well-balanced portfolio from an income perspective, without imploding the volatility of a well-balanced portfolio. These are typically more stable strategies, but importantly, they also have a low correlation to traditional asset classes. So in a well-balanced portfolio, they would tend to reduce your overall portfolio risk.
And I want to ask you one more question before we get into our weirdest thing. And as Crystal mentioned at the top of the show, there's a lot to talk about there in terms of Thanksgiving and crypto and all these other things happening this week. But the one thing we really haven't talked about yet is the state of the consumer. I know I get a lot of reports about holiday shopping trends. And then we also had earnings from the, big box Walmarts and Targets, and all of them have been passing cost increases onto the consumer and so on. So how much of everything is dependent on the state of the consumer and the well-being of the consumer?
Well, our sense is that the consumer continues to drive the recovery and is an instrumental source of, a strong economy, particularly in the US, but also here in Canada and globally as well. And the good news is that the consumer right now does have some ammunition to rising prices. You look at the abundance of savings that have been stashed over the last, several months that are ripe for spending as, the consumer goes out and resumes those normal activities, whether it's taking a vacation or, spending more money on the services side, going out to restaurants, et cetera. So our sense is that the consumer will continue to, be a driving force for the economy. At the same time, the job market, in our view, will continue to improve. Wages will be on the rise. Already in some parts of the market, we're seeing some sizable wage gains. So all of this taken together, reinforces our positive outlook for the backdrop for consumption.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
And I know I asked both of you to come prepared with some of the craziest or weirdest things you saw in markets this week. And I feel like we've hinted at a bunch of them already. But Crystal, I feel like you have a big list of things that you've been watching all week. I hope you prove me right.
Yes. It would be so easy to reach for the volcano bond. That's the world's first sovereign bond that will build a Bitcoin city. El Salvador plans to issue $1 billion in tokenized USD-denominated 10-year bonds. But that's not my weird thing of the week. My weird thing of the week is this thing called a Constitution DAO. That goes back to my crypto beat. This DAO, or a decentralized autonomous organization, think of it basically as a club born on the internet. It's the AOL chat room of the future, but it has an agenda. So the Constitution DAO was a group of people who raised something like $47 million to buy a really old, really valuable physical copy of the Constitution. Spoiler alert, they failed pretty fantastically. The private individual that outbid them turned out to be none other than hedge fund billionaire Ken Griffin. But what was unusual to me, maybe no one saw it this way, but to me, the Constitution DAO effectively did a SPAC. They pooled some money to buy something. And in the Wall Street world, when a SPAC fails on the promise of I'm going to buy a thing, people are generally disappointed and want their money back. But in crypto world, this DAO failed to do this thing they set out to do. And in the wake of this failure, it would seem they have greater support to do something else. And that's my unusual thing of the week.
I love this. And the analysis of all of this and comparing it to SPACs, this is really good. Candace, I'm sorry, but this is a really high bar, I feel like.
I was just going to say, Crystal, that you set the bar extremely high, and I don't think I can match that. I've been sort of brainstorming here as I was listening to your fascinating discovery there about some of the events this week. And of course, I'm a boring strategist. So I think about the headlines that I've seen that sort of make me scratch my head a little bit and go, that's interesting. And I think one of the, sort of perplexing market responses that I've seen this week is the renomination or the outcome of the renomination of Chair Powell. I was quite surprised to see the markets respond in such a hawkish fashion, given that it's essentially suggesting status quo, for the Fed going forward. And, by bringing Brainard up to vice chair, it seems to me that that's going to add a more dovish leaning bias at that vice chair position. So I was quite surprised to see the market adjust the way that it did following that announcement. Looking at the rate hike expectations, I think, more than 5 rate hikes priced now by the end of 2023. So that seems a little bit overdone given that status quo, situation at the Federal Reserve. And I think one more thing I'd point out, I know you only asked for one, but just something that's lingering in the background now is these tensions that have been emerging between oil consumers and producers. Obviously major consuming nations such as the US, but also in coordination with China, Japan, South Korea, India, all talking about releasing strategic reserves to get those oil prices down a little bit. But at the same time, you've got OPEC, pushing back and even reportedly reconsidering their upcoming supply increase. So that'll be very interesting to watch going forward. And I think we'll just, inject a little bit more volatility into the crude markets after what's been a pretty strong rally.
And the interesting thing to me about those headlines was just looking at the list of countries that the U.S. is working with. So we have all these tensions with China, and at the same time, the U.S. is working with China and Japan and South Korea and so on making this happen.
Yeah, no, it's a fully coordinated move, and we'll have to see how everything shakes out. But I think there could be, some volatility around those headlines here in the coming weeks.
Well, my craziest thing also has to do with crypto. So we're really crypto heavy on weirdest things again this week. It's so easy to find a lot of really interesting stuff there. But I was looking at the crypto.com deal to rename the Staples Center in LA so that it bears the crypto.com name. And it seems like that has actually already paid for itself in some ways, because the token for crypto.com has surged something like 50-55% in the wake of that announcement, which is just, there's just so many huge moves happening in the crypto space when it comes to some of these tokens and some, frankly, that maybe we've never heard of before until they start making headlines. But I think Katie Greifeld put it best. She said, this deal for the Staples Center to be renamed, it's a 20-year deal. And she said, I thought we were all supposed to be in the metaverse in 20 years. So it's really interesting to think about. But it's been really great to have you both on the show. And I'd love to have you back on in the future. Crystal, thank you so much for joining us. I know crypto is your beat now, but you do really well as a stock markets reporter too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Candace. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for one-upping me on the craziest things of the week, both of you.
Yours were good. Yours were really good, too. Thanks for being on the show.
That was great. Thanks again.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me, at Vildana Hyrick. Crystal Kim is at Crystal Kim with 3 M's. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. What Goes Up is produced by the amazing Topher Forges. This is actually Topher's last week with us. Topher, thank you for all your amazing work and patience in dealing with Mike Regan all these years. We'll really, really miss you. And for everybody else, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.